Hey, this is Dave Tuff from Nashville, Tennessee, producer engineer, and you're listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind the curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with one of Nashville's most sought-after drummers. We'll talk with Andy Hull. We'll talk about how he got his start in Nashville, how he navigates Nashville studios, and we'll take a deep dive into his time on the road with Clint Black. Now, I met Andy a while back while working on a project with Matt McClure. Matt's a producer and engineer in Nashville. I instantly became a huge fan of Andy's work. He was not only talented, but he was extremely creative. We got along so well that I ended up hiring him for most of my projects from that point forward. I really look forward to our conversation today. So, if you'd like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. Sir, how are you?
Good to be here.
It is so good to have you, my friend.
Thank you.
It's been quite a little while.
It has.
All right, let's just jump in, my friend. How'd you get your start in Nashville?
I got my start in Nashville through Berklee, actually. I wanted to go to Berklee School of Music.
My hometown.
Went up there. I auditioned, and I didn't know how to read music at the time. So I didn't get the audition. I didn't make it. So I thought, I want to go to a music school. Do I go to LA? Someone brought up Belmont. That's where I ended up going, is Belmont. Came back to Chattanooga, where I grew up. I'm in Nashville now. But I grew up in Chattanooga, came back, learned how to read music, got into Belmont. That's my start.
When you say read music, I assume you mean traditionally.
Yeah, that was the thing. Traditionally, I learned how to read music, and then I started interning for EMI Publishing through Belmont and found out that they read number charts. So it was quite a bit different, a different kind of chart than what I was used to reading. I read the scored music, obviously the notation. And that was set in front of me, and I almost had a heart attack. But fortunately, a gentleman who's recently passed, Michael Rhodes, bass player, may he rest in peace, looked at me and could see the panic on my face and said, "You read scored music, don't you?" And I said, "I do." And he said, "All the numbers are bars. Everything else is the same." Saved my butt.
So did you find it easier or harder to read the number system?
It was easier. Once I knew that those were measures for me, you know, they're chords for the real musicians, the guitar players, the keyboard players, the bass player, and whatnot. But yeah, once I realized it's just measures, the same thing, it was easy. All the other notations, basically the same.
So do you draw the other notations over the number system?
Yeah, I will. Sometimes on a session, when you do a lot of sessions, you're coming up with parts on your own, usually. And sometimes they'll tell you, "Hey, we want an eighth note pattern, or we want this type of pattern." I'll write the patterns in above the numbers. I'll write all that in, yeah. And sometimes when I do live stuff, I will write it out verbatim. There are a lot of artists that want to hear the drums a certain way, or the parts a certain way, or specific parts a certain way, and I'll write all that in.
So did your career take off after college, or did it take off while you were in college?
During. In fact, while I was interning, a drummer who will remain nameless because he had chemical issues, didn't show up for a session. And I was there, and Miles, the guy that had hired me as an intern, who was the engineer at EMI, was sitting there. Everybody was saying, "What do we do? Drummer's not here. It's 10 o'clock. That's downbeat time." And Miles goes, "He plays drums." I thought, "Wow, great. Thanks a lot, Miles." But yeah, I started doing sessions that way. I did a couple because I did that session that one day, I was in the right place at the right time, as they say. And I thought, you know what? I'm working now. So I quit school. I wish I hadn't. I kind of wish I had finished the next 2 years. I was there 2 years, and I kind of wish I had finished it out, but it ended up good.
Well, I mean, most people go through the full 4 years and then hope to get a career after it. So if your career started at the beginning, that's probably a good sign.
It is. I will say to everybody out there, any beginners that may hear this, if you can do any type of internship or any type of gig that might even seem like it's meaningless or pointless, it could lead to something always. That's what happened with me with the internship, at least.
So you were working, was it publishing at that point?
Yeah, EMI was just a publishing house. Yeah.
So songwriting demos?
Mostly, yeah.
And how quick was it from that point that your work just started picking up?
Back then, this would have been 91, 92. I'd say, you know, within months, work picked up. If you're available and you're on a session, that session can lead to another one because everybody's there and they'll go, hey, are you all available for this, this, and this? And then the word gets out that way as well. Networking, that's why I say the internship or some form of live gig or something that you can do that you would network through is just gold.
Yeah, networking is key in all of this, for sure.
It is. In any business, probably, but yeah, especially music.
Now, we've had a chance to work together on a number of projects, and I noticed at the time that you were carting your own gear. Do you still cart your own gear?
I do. I'm playing with Clint Black Live now a lot, and on that, you know, there's a kit that lives in a storage unit or in the back of a semi. So all of that is done for me, fortunately. He's got an amazing crew out there, and they take care of all that for me, but still to this day on sessions, and now today on sessions, there's house kits. There's a drum set in most studios now, but I never did do cartage. You know, it's a funny thing, but perception can determine whether or not you get a gig sometimes, I found out. Some people didn't like the fact that I was toting my own drums in there, but there are other musicians that are masters that I've gotten to play with, and I watched them tote their own amps and guitars in as well. So
well, I actually respect it.
Well, thank you.
We had Jeff King on here last week.
I love him.
He's awesome. But we were talking about cartage as well. But the only time I could see where cartage would come in handy is when you're doing a morning session somewhere and an afternoon session somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Especially for you as a drummer, when there's a lot of pieces that need to be set up, it would be nice to have somebody else setting up your next session for you.
Absolutely. But like I said, nowadays, most of the studios here in Nashville have a house kit. They have a drum set already there set up, but I just bring odds and ends, like snares that I want, and then brass, the cymbals, and any percussion or anything like that. The basic drum set is there, toms, kick drum, kick pedal. They usually have all the hardware's there, and I just go in and throw the metal up and then put a snare out there. And sometimes they've got a bunch of snare drums too.
Well, while we're talking about that, what kind of kit are you playing these days?
Well, I'm recording Gretsch, and then the kit I have on the road is a Trick kit, T-R-I-C-K. It's really cool. It's made out of airplane aluminum, so it's a metal kit. It's fantastic. Hey, it weathers really well. It doesn't care if it's hot or cold out. It doesn't bother it like it does wood. It's a really nice kit.
Well, for a live purposes, that's going to be great, whether it's traveling the semi or whether you're playing in Arizona or up north somewhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The finish on it never cracks. No, it's great to have.
Do you still have that yellow kit?
Yeah, it's no longer yellow. Okay. Speaking of weathered, I was playing for Tandy Tucker. We were up in South Dakota, and it was 23 below zero.
Dear God.
And they unloaded the trailer with my drums, and I had flight cases. They were in nice flight cases. And the drums Jay's talking about was a yellow, canary yellow covering that was on the drums itself, like Tony Williams yellow, they called it, because he had a yellow Gretsch. And that's basically why I wanted that kit, because I was a fan of Tony. I love Gretsch because I'm also a fan of Phil Collins, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so they didn't know it, but the local crew rolled everything in. And instead of letting it acclimate to the inside weather, the heat, they opened the cases right. The second they brought everything in there, and there was par cans, really bright lights. Now we have LEDs. They're not quite as hot. Just you could hear the coverings on the drums cracking and the glue separating from the wood. So I had to have them recovered. So they're no longer yellow, but it's the same kit.
Oh, that's horrible.
It sucks, but whatever.
Dude, I've worked on a number of sessions with you, and when you first started coming in, it was always with the yellow kit, and then one day you came in with a different one, and I was disappointed before you even played it. I just love the way that yellow kit sounded. It was awesome.
It's a great kit. And then the snare drum, I use the snare drum to that kit to this day. It's a deeper snare, and it's sought after. A lot of people want to hear it.
It's an amazing sounding kit. It really is.
Thank you.
Well, when you go in, you've got your gear. Do you set it up a certain way every time as far as the kit goes? Do you put things like your headphone amp in a certain spot every time? Do you carry a laptop with you?
I carry a Pelican case that has my sticks in it. It has little pieces of percussion, but it also has a mixing board and a little click station is what I call it, next to the mixing board. And then I can plug in from the cue mix of the studio if I need to. Usually that setup, the Pelican and everything is great for live, but in the studio I'll use it sometimes. And also I can connect my laptop to create loops and stuff. And it runs through the mixer so I can hear it without bugging everybody else while I'm creating a loop. They don't have to listen to it until it's done. And then as far as the drums, you know, all drummers set up differently. You know, all the angles are different and stuff like that. So when I sit down, I'll definitely change it up a little bit, tune it if I need to. Sometimes I'll walk in there and a great drummer was in there the night before or something, and they've already got it tuned fantastic. So I don't have to touch it. But sometimes I'll retune things. And whatever the producer or the writer or whatever, whomever hired me wants, I'll tune it according to their specifications as well or to the type of song style.
Do you tune to the key of the song? Or do you tune to the style of music?
You can, but I tune to the style of music. Not a lot of drummers will tune to the key. Some drummers will try and tune the snare drum. If there's any type of ring, they'll try to tune it to a certain key. But as long as you're not hearing any weird overtones or weird frequencies, I tune the snare where I think it's appropriate for the style of the song and just when it sounds good. It's in tune with itself, so to speak.
So when you do go into a studio, can you describe to us what the day is typically like for you?
Yeah. I show up a little earlier than some folks do for the guitar player, bass player. Sometimes they're there because they work on their pedals and get sounds through their pedals, depending on what type of setup they have. But I get there early. Coffee is the very first thing I do. I look for a coffee maker or coffee that's already brewed. Got to have the coffee. And then I set everything up. I put everything where I want it as far as where the toms and everything are setting to my specifications. I hang the cymbals, check out the cue mix. Sometimes the engineer will send test sounds down for me of my own drums or something they've recorded another day to where I can turn up the guitar where I want it. Cause a lot of the cue mixes, when you go in, a cue mix is like a little, it's like a little mixer, which you know, Jay, but sometimes it'll have faders or just knobs on it to where you can do individual instruments like guitar. You can do your own levels, bass, you can do your own level. Usually the drums are in a stereo mix or they call it a two mix to where you can just turn the drums up or down. And I'm at the mercy of the engineer as far as individual sounds, but usually sounds really good. But then I mess with that. I get that where I want it. And then we will typically go into the control room and we'll start listening to songs and then we'll make magic.
So you go in and you listen to the song. I'm assuming at that point somebody's already charted it and you're holding a chart in front of you. Are you taking notes at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely taking notes.
Is it just the odd requests that somebody might have or drum notations?
Both. Sometimes we'll go in and we'll just listen and we'll make sure the arrangement's the way that the writer or the artist or producer wants it to be. We'll discuss if there's any type of other song that this song's supposed to sound like stylistically. We're going for this. So they'll play an example maybe of another song. If they don't do that, they'll just say it's just a typical pop country song, or it's more traditional, think in terms of that. because sometimes we'll listen to a full demoed song. And what I mean is it might be programmed drums or something, someone with an acoustic, but there might be bass parts. And we'll just kind of mimic that. And they'll say, the artist or whatever will say, let's do what we're hearing here exactly, or we don't have to do it exactly, but this is kind of the idea. Just make it today if it's like an old demo. And sometimes just an acoustic demo. So I'll sit down and I'll ask, is everybody in at the top? How do we want to do this? Do we want to build it? Do we want to be all in and break it down? And then we'll discuss that. And then we'll write in the proper terms, I guess, or the notation to let us know when to do what, where, or what not to do.
Well, I know the session leader has a lot of collaboration with the producer and oftentimes the engineer. Do you feel that you're part of that collaboration?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. They might do stuff, what we call pre. They will go in before and discuss some things. Usually a producer, an artist, and the band leader will all do that. And then the rest of us, like you, an engineer, somebody will be there day of, and we're all, you know, hearing it for the first time. But usually the session leaders heard it before everybody else because they're typically the one that makes the charts. But sometimes the producer will make the charts. Not often the artist will, but sometimes. So there's a lot of artists that are very skilled in that department. I got to play on some demos for Chris Stapleton, and he's able to do all that kind of stuff. But he's a songwriter. Yeah, he's a songwriter. He's a player, obviously, singing, son of a gun. So he knows all that stuff. So there are people that, artists that know everything, inside out, top to bottom. But yeah, usually the band leader will write out the charts and they'll get a sense of everything beforehand. And sometimes they don't know exactly what style. They'll just write out a chart based on the demo and they'll just give us the form on the numbers, and then they'll talk about it when we get there. So the session leader might not even know exactly what's going to happen. Things can change as we're playing it. We could play it down once, and the artist or the producer or somebody might say, hey, man, why don't we break down the bridge or bring the bridge down rather than plow through it loud like everything else. So there's all sorts of stuff like that that happens.
Well, there's a couple good points you just mentioned. One, if you're talking, you have a structure, a foundation of a song, and you're playing different feels throughout it for each individual musician. But are there times where you actually change the arrangement, like on the fly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you might play it through once, and they might say, the solo's too long. Somebody might say, hey, how long was that? It was 4 minutes. Well, that's way too long for radio. So they'll say, let's get rid of a turnaround or an intro or something like that. Let's half the intro. If the intro's 8 measures, they'll say, let's get rid of 4 measures and just do 4 measures. Or they won't usually change a verse or a chorus. Now, they might add a chorus. They might say, let's play the chorus twice at the end and then do an outro to finish the song out. They can add there or they can add solos. Lately, I don't hear a whole lot of guitar solos anymore.
No, which is sad, especially when we get somebody like Jeff King there.
Oh, absolutely.
Man, absolutely. I love listening to him play.
Breaks my heart. There's a lot of great players in town, and it's a shame they can't be more showcased.
You mentioned Chris Stapleton, and you've worked with countless people in the studio. Is it hard for you? Are there any challenges going from one artist to another?
Challenges. I don't look at challenges as a bad thing. I guess there are challenges, but every artist is different. They interpret things differently. They communicate differently. That's a big thing. Some artists, like I say, Chris, and other artists, Clint, they know music enough to be able to communicate in musical terms. You know, some people, they communicate by saying, I want it fuller, or I want it busier, you know, instead of saying, hey, why don't we do 16th note pattern rather than an 8th note pattern? So those can be challenges just through communication, but everybody does things pretty much the same once we get there. So I don't see it as a challenge. There are some artists that really want specific things, and some players are used to going in and just doing something the way they would interpret it. And then the artist or producer or writer will say, I'm not really hearing it that way. Can we try this? Which I love. There was a time where I thought, well, that's going to sound like crap. That's just dumb. And then I'll play it and it absolutely works. And if it is dumb and sounds stupid, once you play it, that person's going to hear that anyway. And they're going to go, oh, never mind. Bad idea.
Right.
So yeah, those would be the only challenges that I have, you know, been involved in. There's nothing that's been like, I've left there weeping or angry.
I hope not. Right.
No.
And so if you're building this career in the studio, and I know there's in Nashville as well as most other places, there's luck that plays into this, but what kind of advice would you give to somebody who wants to become the next session player?
Networking. Absolutely networking. And really trying to find folks that are in the studio world to network with, maybe a songwriter. They still do writer's rounds, I think, in town. I'm bad about that. I'm horrible at networking, so I'm one to give advice about networking. But it's true. I mean, that's really important to be able to network. But also, before you even network, make sure you know how to read charts, number charts, scored music. I do jingles and those, especially out of LA or New York, but mostly LA that I've done. That's all written out and you have to play it verbatim. So there's notation there. So it's good to learn to read all of that, the notation, and then also number charts, national number charts, which are brilliant, by the way. They're fantastic. They change the key. The one becomes the new key. So know how to read music and know how to navigate in the studio, listen to other people, players that have done it for a long time, listen to their advice or listen to their stories, what they've been through. They're usually going to tell you how a lot of stuff goes down in the studio, but networking would be the biggest thing. And be nice, be a cool dude or a cool gal. Goes a long way.
That's something that everybody says every time you ever ask for advice. They say, well, just be nice. Just Absolutely. Be nice, be good hang, be good to be around.
Yep. And nobody's better than anybody else. So don't ever go in with an attitude. And I don't see a lot of that. So I hate even saying that, but it can happen. And sometimes people get nervous and that can be looked at as arrogance when it's not. But yeah, just be kind, but network, you know, be a people person. Somebody that's a people person is Jeff King, my friend. It's always a pleasure working on a session with him, but never, ever leave your chart sitting there alone with Jeff King. He will change notations if you leave the room to go to the bathroom and not tell you, and then you'll play it wrong.
Yep.
And everyone knows what's going on but you. He's notorious for that, or he used to be.
I told him the other night, I said, look, I hope you don't take offense to this, but you are a huge jokester.
Yes,
and he is. I mean, but that's what made the sessions lighthearted and fun. And like he said, when it's lighthearted and fun, you play at your best.
You do. Everybody's comfortable. When everybody's comfortable and having fun with it, it's music. It's supposed to be fun. You can't overthink it. You shouldn't overthink it. You should feel it. You should enjoy it. That's the whole idea. And having somebody like Jeff, that's why he gets hired. I mean, he's a phenomenal player, but also he's just, you want to be around somebody like that.
He has a presence to him. He just walks in. He's just a big guy, and he doesn't look like a musician.
No, but. No, he doesn't act like a musician. No, yes, he does. Yeah. Sadly, he acts like a musician.
Before we move on here, can you tell me what studios you like? You have any favorites?
Studios? No, I have venues that I love over other venues. My favorite venue in the States is Red Rocks.
Oh, yeah.
I love that venue.
We're talking about that with Scotty Simpson.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Scotty, bass player. Yeah, studios, you know, everybody wants to play in your ocean ways and your big rooms and things like that, which is fun. But, man, I've also been in I liked EMI back even before they refurbished it. And I like the small studios too. It's hard for me to say that one studio is better than another. Now an engineer can make the difference. When your cue mix sounds really good, things like that. Yeah, that makes a big difference. But the studio itself, I love that there are big differences in every studio. I really do. I love that. But the ultimate goal is usually achieved no matter what studio it's in. A lot of people don't realize that some of the greatest albums ever recorded were like in the basement of a house
or, right,
you know, an old warehouse or something like that. They have no idea. They think it's this, you know, ornate, beautiful Ocean Way, which are phenomenal. Blackbird, I love Blackbird.
John and Martina McBride studio.
Yeah, it's a fantastic place. I love recording there. But, you know, I love recording in some of the houses. The House of David, in fact, is a studio that I enjoy. But it's an old house. There was a place called Bennett House. They did a lot of Christian records in Franklin. I don't think it's there anymore. I mean, the structure's still there. It was an old mansion. But it was a nice, it was literally a house. They still had the dining room table in the dining room, and sometimes the drums would be sitting next to the dining room table. But things like that I love about different studios.
Well, like you, I've had the opportunity to work in these studios, Ocean Way and so on.
Yeah.
But still to this day, my favorite studio is a studio in Boston that no longer exists. It was called ESS Studios. And it was just a small 16-track studio, but the vibe and the fun and the people that worked there, that's what made it, you know, great.
Absolutely.
In Nashville, it seems like that vibe and those people were still there, but they moved from studio to studio.
Yes.
So you get in that group of a handful of players or a handful of engineers or people you worked with, and you'd work with them at Ocean Way and you'd work with them at the Parlor.
Yep.
That's the difference, I guess.
Yes.
So what kind of challenges did you find when you started playing on the road?
Oh, wow. Well, I hate to say it, but Nashville was the type of town when I started, 92, like I said, 93, where you could be pigeonholed. See, I didn't know this at the time. And I thought, because I was a huge Genesis fan, and Yes, and bands like that, they all played on their records. So I really, when I moved to town, I thought that the artist's band, road band, would play on the records. And when I got to intern at EMI, I found out that, oh, you can do sessions for a living. But I also thought, hey, every now and then you can go out on the road. But no, there was a stigma to that for some reason. And now studio is different than live playing. It really is. It's a controlled environment. You're under a microscope. Any small things that you do are made bigger through the microphones and being under that microscope. And live can be merciful whenever certain mistakes are made, because it goes by. But in the studio, it is different. So there are differences in the type of playing. But that was a challenge that I had when I went on the road. I lost some of the contacts because I wanted to play with some artists on the road. And when I got back, I realized, okay, you either got to stay in town or be on the road. It was really hard to do both. You could. There were players that did both, but there might still be a challenge today, but I find an equal live to session ratio in my life right now. I mean, you always want to do more of everything as a musician. At least I do. I love it all, but studio is my favorite. But yeah, it can be a challenge if you decide you want to go on the road with somebody for a long period of time. You lose contacts in town. There's a lot of great players in town and a lot of great players on the road. So if you choose to do one over the other, it could be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I used to tell students that all the time, that if you want to be a mix engineer, you don't want to go intern at a mastering house.
Right.
Because if you're at the mastering house, you're just going to be networking with all of those people, and you're not ever going to network with the people in the mix studios.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I definitely see that. And I've talked to even Jeff and Scotty about the challenges of that. And Scotty really sees it, and Jeff doesn't see it that much. So yeah. Scotty is pigeonholed into being on the road, where Jeff was in the studio and on the road, and he's been able to balance that.
Yes, very well. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, let's go ahead and take a deeper dive into your road career. And you're traveling around with Clint Black at the moment. What's that like?
It's wonderful. Like I said, the crew is amazing. I have to say, crew guys and gals are everything, man. They can... Well, they do everything. We get to get up there and act like rock stars. Clint's a really good artist to work for. The band is fantastic. Everybody's really good on the road. So that part of it is is wonderful. Get to stay in nice places. We travel on buses when we're not flying, and it's a blessing, man. It really is. It's wonderful.
Do you like traveling on bus or plane better?
Well, nowadays, bus. But, you know, you don't want to ride on a bus for 16 hours or, you know, 2 days or anything like that. So you'll definitely hop on a plane. But I prefer riding on the bus because on a bus, you get to sleep in a bunk. You know, it's some people call it a rolling hallway because it is, it's narrow, but you've got a bunk, got a back lounge and a front lounge, big screen televisions, you know, direct TV or whatever, satellite. You're not hurting.
I remember the limited time I had traveling around, I was on the bunk and I felt like I was sitting in a coffin.
Yes,
but
that's true.
Get used to it. And then it had the little TV that would pop down like inches from my face.
Yes, exactly. So. And sometimes in the middle of the night, if you forget where you are, you will hit your head on that TV. Yes, there are those moments.
I forget who it was. We were traveling around in, I think it was Steve Holy. It was on the road with Steve Holy and the bus took a turn and got caught on a light post or something while I was sleeping. I didn't even know what happened.
That's amazing. You didn't know. Usually that's the type of thing where you start bracing for impact,
right?
Praying to God, please take me to heaven.
Well, yeah. I was lucky I was asleep because otherwise I probably would have freaked out a little because you wouldn't know it was coming. You don't see outside. You're not looking out windows.
Yes. Not in the bunks. Well, there might be some buses that have portals in them. I haven't been on one, though, so you don't know what's happening. So if you hear, and nowadays you hear it a lot because there's construction, but if you start hearing the rumble strips, you wake up panicked because,
like,
okay,
what's happening?
Is that construction or are we going off the road? Is this it?
Right. Is the driver sleeping?
Yes. Oh, please. Oh, God. Don't say it. Hasn't happened. Knock on something.
Yeah. All right. So how did you get hooked up with this tour to begin with?
Networking.
See, you say you're not good at it, but here we go again.
Well, the other thing is when the ball gets rolling, that's helpful as well. You don't have to go out and search for work. Once you do start getting work and you've made it to that point, you start getting phone calls. There was a producer in town that said, when the phone rings, take every gig, especially in the beginning, because that gig could lead to another gig. And some of the crappiest gigs that you may think you're playing on could end up catapulting you into a bigger career. Happens for a lot of guys playing dives and showcases, which I don't know if they do a lot of showcases anymore, but gigs like that where it's, you're not getting on a bus or a plane and staying in a nice hotel, but a smaller gig could lead to that gig. Same with sessions. Like I said, if you get called on a session and you're in that session, and if you're doing a songwriter demos for a group of guys, like I had done Chris Stapleton, you know, we would do 15 or 20 songs that day, all with different writers. Those writers might be booking another session and say, hey, I want these players because they're crazy like Jeff King and I want them on my next session. So you're there. So that's another form of networking. And that's why I take as many gigs as I possibly can, even if they're, quote, you know, low paying or, you know, they're not star studded by any means. Right. And that could lead to something else, but it gets your name out there as well. That's one way to do it. I'm bad at going to a bar and hanging out with folks and doing that kind of networking. But if I'm able to do the gig, I'll try to network through that.
Well, absolutely. And it's a perfect point because just like you were saying earlier, if you don't take a gig, one might be fine. But if you turn the same person down two, maybe three times, they're not going to call you the next time.
That's true.
So you have to be available. And so if, like you're saying, if you're on the road for an extended period of time, you're not going to get that gig.
Absolutely. You run into that.
Yeah. And where a lot of people on the road, especially in country music, they just go out for the weekends.
Yes.
So that helps because if you can get a weekend gig where you're just traveling different places on the weekends, you can come back and play in the studio during the week.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's a good point. And it's true to a point with Clint's gigs as well. Sometimes when we go out west, we may be out there for a few days longer. We might do 2 weeks because we just stay out there. But sometimes we'll go out there and there'll be 4 or 5 days off. And fortunately, he's kind enough to fly us back home, some of us, because, you know, we still have sessions that we do here in town. So he's kind enough for those 4 or 5 days off to fly us back home, and then we fly back out and finish out the shows out there.
Very good. So when you are on the road with them, what's your favorite memory?
Oh, all the shows. I mean, I love playing the shows. That's, you know, it's hard to say what a favorite memory is, but the playing is always my favorite part. Even sound check. We go and do sound check. I enjoy it. We're getting to play.
Well, that's another good point, too. If you follow Andy at Hull Andy, you can see he actually films his sound checks and he films the, you know, performances whenever possible and stuff. Does a lot of behind the scenes stuff. It's a really cool account to follow.
Thank you.
So I know a lot of people go out on the road in like they're jokesters and they play pranks on each other. Do you have any things like that going on?
No, not everybody likes to joke and everybody is sarcastic. That's always fun. I'm pretty boring. When I go out on the road, I like to go for runs and I go to the gym. So let me say, there's a lot of eating on the road. There's a lot of eating and there's a lot of nap taking, apparently. Right, I don't do much of the nap taking.
I'd be a superstar.
Yeah. So, you know, the pranks are limited because most of the guys are asleep in the middle of the day in their bunk or at the hotel. So there's not a whole lot of pranking going on, but there's a lot of joke telling. There is a lot of that. I mean, Clint is hilarious in his show. He's very funny in between songs. And the rest of the guys in the band are absolutely hilarious too. So it's always fun. It's like being around Jeff King all the time.
Well, he's also super talented in the song Like the Rain.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's one of my favorites. I love that song.
Yes.
But song. How has he influenced your playing?
Well, he's particular in what he wants to hear. Now, when I came in, I was taking over for Dickie, who is his drummer from, I'm going to get the years wrong, but over 30 years, I think. He was there from the beginning. So there was a getting to know each other period. And there's things that Clint or any artist is used to hearing. So they want it to be a specific way for various reasons. And actually, it makes sense. And a female artist, well, Joni Messina, I got to play with her for a few shows.
Fellow Bostonian.
That's right. Absolutely. She's a freaking amazing singer. But she made a good point. When I wrote the charts out for the songs, I had been told, you know, wherever you hear drum fills, do drum fills. But what I didn't know until sound check is she wants the drum fills that were actually on the recorded board tape, the show tape that I had to learn the songs from. She wanted exact, like if it's Pat Boone, Debbie Boone, or Frank Sinatra, she wants to hear those specific fills. And the reason she gave was great. She said, I know drummers hate that. You know, they want to just do a fill, and that's part of their time to be creative and shine. But she said, I like to interact with the crowd, and sometimes I'll forget, okay, are we on course two? Are we getting ready to go to the bridge? And if I hear Pat Boone, Debbie Boone, that's my cue. I cue off the drummer. Some people cue off guitar or other things, but you know, artists like specific cues or they like specific grooves to be a certain way. And Clint's the same. So there was some getting to know each other when I first got the gig. I've only been with him like 2 years, but you know, we've gotten to know each other, you know, musically as well as personally, but that took some time. I like it when an artist or a producer or a writer knows what they like and can tell me, hey, I want you to do this or I want you to try that. Because this is a service industry and that's what we're supposed to do. We're there to do what they ask us to do. And we can have ideas. It doesn't mean you can't say, hey, can I try this? Because I've said that with various artists when they've asked me to do something. I'll say, man, I'm just not feeling that. Is it all right if I tried this? And it's, you know, splitting the difference between what they wanted and what felt right to me. And sometimes they'll say, absolutely. And sometimes they'll go, no, I want this. And you go, okay, done. You got it. Absolutely. But Clint knows what he wants. And that's what I do. And it's good. I mean, it's his career has been fantastic. So he's doing something right.
Well, that's a good point, too. I mean, Joni Messina, you know, she's great. And I love her. I've never had a chance to work with her, but I love her. But I know she worked a lot with Phil Vassar And yes. I had a chance to work with Phil Vassar, who was very particular on what he wanted and the way he wanted things. Yes. He was very laid back about it, but he was very particular about what he wanted. Yeah. So yeah. I know all artists are different. So what kind of differences have you found going from other artists to Clint?
He's more specific than some, but I played with Lee Greenwood. He's kind of that way as well. They know music well enough to really know what to ask for. So they're very specific. And I guess I could, Jody, she's very specific. Some artists, they don't like what they're hearing maybe, and they don't know exactly how to ask for, or they don't really know exactly what they want. They just know they don't want what you're doing right now, which is fine. And I, like I said, I love that. One of my favorite drummers in the world, Vinnie Caliuta, I was listening to an interview with him, and he was talking about how he was getting into the session world, or he was into the session world, I should say. And he was doing a record for an artist that wanted a specific drum part, you know, and Vinnie, when he played it the way Vinnie would play it. And the guy came in and said, "I like what you're doing, but can you do this?" And actually scooted Vinnie off the drum throne and sat down and played it. And Vinnie thought, "Okay, I'm Vinnie Caliuta here." but he played it. He played what the guy wanted. And he said he went into the control room and listened and said it was the perfect part. It absolutely was the perfect part. And from then on, he listened to whatever he was asked to do. Because like I said earlier, if it isn't going to work, the artist is going to hear that it isn't going to work. I mean, you can think in your mind, and I've done that too. I thought this is going to be a disaster. And then I went in the control room and went, "Oh my gosh, that absolutely works," because everybody fell into it. And when you've got great players that can do that and play off of each other like that, you're creating magic. When you thought, "No, I don't think that's going to work," or "I'm not going to play it well enough." That's another thing that you worry about as a player. You go, "Okay, I'm not a great Latin drummer. I can do basic Latin things." But there's some guys and gals out there that, wow, I mean, they can play the Latin grooves just amazingly. So I have limitations for sure.
I think we all do.
Well, yeah, we all do. That's another thing to be comfortable with. And that's something else. I know I'm getting off track here a little bit, but that I would tell people, and I just did a gig a while back. It wasn't with Clint. It was with an up-and-coming artist, and they were fantastic artists. But you're thrown into a situation, like with Clint, all my stuff is set up exactly the way I want it every single time. I get to just walk out there, sit down, and it's done. The crew is amazing. And it sounds the same every night, good. But sometimes you're going to get thrown, especially if you're a work-for-hire, which most of us are, you're going to get thrown into situations where you're out of your comfort zone. Get comfortable out of your comfort zone, because there's going to be many. Oh, the Opry is the perfect example. The Opry is great to play. I enjoy playing the Opry, but you literally, the band before you does a downbeat. You've got 30 seconds to get up there, sit down, get situated, and ladies and gentlemen, and then you're counting the song off. I mean, sometimes it's literally, and Eddie Bears, who's a phenomenal drummer. He's a legend here in Nashville.
Yeah, he's okay. If he practiced a little bit more, he'd be pretty good.
Well, sometimes he's on there in the house band, and he always wants to talk in between. I don't know if he does it on purpose, but he's joking. He always wants to joke around, but he wants to talk sometimes in between while I'm trying to get up there and set up and put the snare where I want it, because he's got it angled completely different than I do. And I love Eddie, so I want to talk to him. But sometimes I think he does it on purpose to test my merit. But be comfortable in uncomfortable situations is something else I guess I would advise everyone out there. Don't get upset when it doesn't sound exactly the way you want it to the point where if you're at home, like you're a guitar player, make your sound sound awful, because sometimes it's going to sound awful. You're not going to have time to gather your pedals or work on your pedal board to get the sounds just right. Same with drummers, man. Get used to playing with the angles of the drums not exactly.
Yeah, if you're playing the Opry after Eddie Bears.
Yeah.
So when you play, you just go with it? You roll with it?
You do. Fortunately, Eddie, because I don't know if many people that don't know it, most drummers will play with their hands crossed. Eddie's open-handed. There's some drummers that are open-handed, so his left hand is usually on the hi-hat and his right hand is on the snare. So they have a ride. It's really a crash ride, which is really nice because there's also a ride on the right. But he has a crash ride type of thing on the left because he plays the ride with his left hand. So that makes things a little different. So you have to acclimate to that like instantly. You don't have time to get used to it. Right. Hopefully you're used to it by the course. So things like that can be very different because I don't change the cymbal heights. I don't have time. I'm more concerned with the snare because I hit a specific way. And if the snare is not angled right, it's just not going to feel or sound right for me. And sometimes I don't have a choice. Eddie's been talking too long. No, but sometimes I don't have time. I mean, sometimes there's 10 seconds in between. So I have to sit down and play it at that angle. And like I said, it doesn't sound or feel right to me, but make it so. Got to learn to do that. Be comfortable in an uncomfortable situation.
Well, he plays that way due to an injury, right?
Yeah, he had a motorcycle accident. Just bad enough to where he wanted to keep playing, and it was too harsh to hit the snare with the left hand because of the injury, so it's a lot lighter on the hi-hat. And you know what? Truthfully, when you sit down, where are your hands? You don't usually cross over to do things. So it's really a more proper way, if you ask me, to play the drums.
Well, he started on piano, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Which is ridiculous to me. That's too much talent in one person.
Yes, yes. No. He's one of those. There are a lot of those guys in this.
He's town. One of those.
Yes, a lot of these guys that can play many instruments very well. I hate them all.
I do. All right, so you're on the road. You're on the road with Clint. When you're out on the road, do you miss being in the studio?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you do. And sometimes when you're in the studio, you might jones to be on the road a little bit or to do a live show. It doesn't necessarily have to be on the road because there's a lot of live playing in Nashville as well. Broadway used to, it might still get a stigma playing down on Broadway. There's a lot of bars down on Broadway. I'm sure a lot of people know that now because a lot of people come here to party. Anyway, but Broadway, there's all sorts of live music down on Broadway. So there's places to play live. So yeah, if you're out on the road for weeks, you totally miss the studio. The studio is my favorite, so I'm missing it all the time. But I like playing live as well. I really do. I really do.
Yeah, I've always liked the studio better than the live, but I enjoy going out and being part of the energy of the live scene.
Yes.
But I'd much rather be in the studio. I could sit there with the dim lights 24/7 and just be just fine.
And that's why I do it out of my house now. I mean, when I'm not on the road, I'm really trying hard to get people to call me to do at-home tracking, you know, those that are doing that, because I love the creativity of it. I love taking something that's bare bones, usually. Like I said, some of it is finished and they want it a specific way. But I love it. I love being creative. And you know, live is kind of like stage acting as well. When you're on the stage acting, if you make a mistake, you've got to compensate right then. In the studio, we can fix it.
Right.
We can punch in. You can't do that live. Once it's done, it's gone. Mistake's been heard and it's there.
Nashville's the only place I've ever seen that's punched in drums. It was kind of crazy to me.
Yes. Yeah. On 2-inch tape.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Back in the day. Yeah, absolutely. Still do it.
You're talking about technology.
Yeah.
How have you seen technology change and how has it helped you?
Oh, it's tremendously changed. Now, I was afraid of it for years, and I had a lot of friends. I have a buddy, Scott Newbert, especially, who's helped me a lot. He told me, you need to get some sort of software back in the day. But I was paranoid. I am not technologically savvy. I'm not like you. I don't have an engineer's mind. So I was scared to death of all that. And what's silly about all of that is when I interned at EMI, I was the second engineer, and I knew nothing about the board. So to torture me, Miles would make me align the tape machine, and I had to align the tape machine every day. And then I found out you don't need to align it every day, but he was making me do that. But I was learning something. It was great. I'm glad that I did that. And then I had to do the editing. And when you did crossfades back then, that meant you were going to cut the tape a specific way. And that was your crossfading. Nowadays, you do all of that in the digital realm. And so I was sweating and shaking and having to cut tape. I mean, I'm cutting tape for people like Emmylou Harris, Billy Dean, and all these huge artists that sometimes I got to record with, but I was also on the other side of the glass, you know, where the engineer is, and I'm cutting tape and editing, and just thinking about it, I'm getting cold chills. But
well, that's the big difference that people don't know is the undo feature. Can't undo a cut on tape.
No. You can fix some things, but no, you get the wrong crossfade or whatever. No, sir. It's ruined. That take is ruined. And those people are long gone. They're not going to recut it right then. But we would do some edits while the musicians were there, probably for that reason. But technology, it's fantastic. And what I really love is the advent of YouTube and social media and stuff like that, where folks are so willing to teach the rest of us. They're happy to do it after they spent all this money going to engineering school. Right. And now they're getting on YouTube and telling it to me for free. Thank you all. I love you so much. Because that's how I learned Pro Tools. I use Pro Tools. My son, who's a guitar player in town, he uses Logic Pro, but he also knows how to run Pro Tools. And that's the beauty, is being able to use the different softwares. I love that. But technology has helped me tremendously. It's allowed me to record out of the house. And now I'm not a real engineer, Jay. I'm not a real engineer, but I can do some engineering things now.
Do you press the big red button?
The space bar. But there's a lot of Command Z going on too. And Command D, I'm afraid to say. But yeah, technology has been good and bad. I miss 2-inch tape, but I do love the digital aspect of things. Because like you said, crossfading and stuff is done digitally, and you can fix things.
Well, I grew up with nothing but tape. There was no digital at the time. Right. And even when we switched to digital, it was digital tape.
Yes, it was.
And then we get to computers and Pro Tools systems, which I love. I mean, if there's anybody that loves Pro Tools, it would be me.
Same. I'm the same.
And I use it every day. So absolutely love it. And I wouldn't go back for anything, but there was something about the tape machines and the smell of the tape and, like you said, aligning the machines.
Sound of it. Listening to it rewind, listening to it in the cans, in your headphones.
That was awesome.
I miss it. Yeah, I miss tape in that regard. But yeah, I wouldn't want to go back either, because there's so much that Pro Tools and stuff like that offer digitally.
Yeah, and if you want to work these days,
yes,
if there's ever a piece of software to master, it would be Pro Tools.
Oh, absolutely. A lot more people use that. And some of them, my son has taught me that, you know, Logic doesn't differ very much. They each have a unique system that they go by that is pretty easy to learn. There's some differences, but you know, it's all WAV files eventually.
It's like anything else. They all do the same thing. It's just a matter of finding the little different nuances here and there that make it slightly different.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you've mentioned your son. What's he up to?
He's up to a lot. He plays electric guitar. He does a lot of jingles. He's been playing with T.G. Shepherd, which is weird because he's 21 years old and he's playing with an older artist, and which he loves it. He's played with Lee Greenwood some.
With you?
No, we didn't get to play together with Lee. We've done other things. We've been on sessions together. He does a lot of sessions. We've done that. And he's actually hired me. He can play drums too. So some things he's able to track the drums, which he's another one of those guys that I hate.
Yeah.
And he plays keyboards and bass, but he's doing that. He's doing a lot of recording. He does track building, which I don't like those guys either, but he's doing real well with all that.
I was telling Jeff the other night that I play bass, I play keyboards, but my brain knows what my hands are supposed to do. I just can't get my hands to do it. So I just don't get, I give up. It's like, that's not my thing. I'd rather sit here behind all these buttons and do my thing.
I'm that way in that I only play drums. When I was at Belmont, we were required. Well, like I said, Evan and people like Jeff, they all play multiple instruments and they make me mad. There's a guy in town, Jason Roller. He plays a bunch of different instruments, fiddle and everything. And those guys have a great skill set, and I don't know how their brains worked where they can, you know, go from a stringed instrument to the piano, to the drums, or to a steel guitar, for Pete's sake. I don't know why anybody would want to play that. No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. I love steel. But I've never had that either. I'm wired to play drums. In fact, when I started playing drums, it was because I wanted to play saxophone, and I went into my middle school band director's office, and he said, "So you want to play saxophone?" I said, "I do." He said, "Well, here, blow into the saxophone. Let's see if you have any natural ability." I blew into that thing. I did it wrong. And he goes,
"Percussion it is."
"We need drummers." And I thought, man, I hate the drums. I don't want to play drums. But now I love playing drums. Absolutely love it.
The sad part is I started with drums. I cannot get, and I don't know how you do, I cannot get all my limbs to do something different.
Practice, baby.
No.
You can.
No
you
way.
You could. I mean, you got to want it, Jay.
I can get the two. If I just did my hands, fine. Just do my feet, fine. Put them together, forget it. No, it doesn't happen.
Independence is hard.
All right. Well, we do this thing here called Unsung Hero. It's where we take a moment to shine the spotlight on somebody who works behind the scenes who might not typically get credit. Do you have anybody that's helped you along the way that you'd like to shine some light on?
I don't have names specifically, but every crew man and woman that I have worked with through the years, everybody that's worked on the crew, the behind the scenes folks that people don't see, or if they do see them, it's because they're on stage putting out a fire, so to speak, or something like that. Like yourself, engineers, a lot of people don't get to see the engineers that actually make the music that we all love to listen to, you know? And a lot of people, they like that. They don't want to be seen. But I would call those my unsung heroes, because all of them, everybody that I've been with, house engineers, monitor engineers, the crew that sets up lights or sets up the screen or sets up drums, or, you know, guitar techs, drum techs, people like that. People that set the stage up, local crews and stuff like that, that come out and help put staging up and hang lights. I mean, these guys that run up in these arenas and hang these lights from 300-400 feet. It's amazing to see. There's video of this out there. Go watch these guys and gals work. And it's men and women. And they're all equally as skilled. And they're the ones that bring us the music. And they're the ones that make us look like rock stars and think that we're cool. So those are my unsung heroes.
I laugh only because when I was in Nashville, I was doing some work for the Nashville Predators, and I was doing their sound. And in between, they thought they'd give me a tour of the facility. And one of the things, we were crossing the catwalk to get from one side to the other.
All the riggers,
I took about five steps and said, yeah, this isn't going to happen.
And some of these... Man, there was a girl, I can't remember what venue we were in. It might have been a hockey arena, actually, now that you mentioned that. It was with Clint. But this girl climbed this little bitty ladder up to do the rigging and was just sprinting across the, what's it called where the lights hang from?
Truss.
Yeah, just sprinting across it. I mean, she had a harness on and everything, obviously. But still, there's no way. There's no way. It was 100 feet. It had to be, at least. And she's running across it like it's no big deal. I would have been crawling and shaking and begging for mommy. Forget it. No, yeah. Sir. No, thank you.
That's funny to me, only because five steps, dude. I got five steps, and I was like, yeah, I don't want to go any further.
Yes, absolutely. Same for me.
Yeah, same because for me. You're talking, it's not even a foot wide.
No.
And the not. Bars are on the sides of you are knee high. They're not up to your waist or anything. I mean, they're at your knees. They're just going to trip you as you fall.
You lose balance, you're gone, man.
Yeah. No. And we didn't have any harness or anything. You know, they're like, well, come on, there's railings. Just hold on to them. I'm like, no. No. Sorry. Yep. I'll go back down behind the control board. That's where
exactly
I belong.
That's exactly right. Which... I love you guys as well. It's just, it's all equal. It's all equal. The crew are the best.
Well, I do appreciate you, buddy. And I can tell you, out of the years now, 30 plus years working in the industry and 20 of that being in Nashville, that you are by far my favorite drummer to ever work with.
Well, so. Thank you, Jay. God bless you. Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much.
And that's only because you pay me.
I know. $50. Is that what we agreed on?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, are we still in the air? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. Andy, sir, you have any final words you'd like to leave us with?
I just appreciate you having me on here.
Now, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I loved hearing Andy's take on performing both live and in the studio. That's something that players struggle with in Nashville, so I'm glad we had a chance to hear Andy's point of view. And I hope you'll join me in giving a big thanks to Andy for joining us this week and sharing his stories. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. You can do just that and find the links to everything mentioned in this episode over at jfranzi.com/episode7. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.